the Delta Quadrant Podcast, part of the TrekMate family.
You are listening to the Delta Quadrant, the Star Trek Voyager podcast. Thank you for the musical intro, Melissa. This is a podcast where we review episodes of Star Trek Voyager in their original broadcast order. Tonight's episode is Imperfection. This is Gino in Oklahoma.
This is Matt in Arizona, the podcast host who will be here until the end of Voyager or die trying.
And I'm Ben from Arizona.
And this is Melissa from North Dakota.
Ben, you weren't here last week, so you didn't get to hear the wonderful cheesy promo that we found from Voyager's last season of Kate Mulgrew just speaking to the camera as Janeway, saying that we're going to get home or die trying.
You might die. Never know.
Well, let's hope not. But here we are in the second episode of Season 7 of Star Trek Voyager. So let's just get right into it. Imperfection. Seven's life is put in danger when a crucial Borg implant malfunctions. This is the second episode of Season 7 of Star Trek Voyager, first aired October 11th, 2000. Teleplay by Carlton Eastlake and Robert Dougherty, story by Andre Bormanis, and it was directed by David Livingston. Guest stars include Manu Interamy as Icheb, Marley S. McLean as Mazzotti, co-starring Michael McFaul as the salvage alien, Debbie Gratton as Wasanti, Kurt Weatherill as Azan, Cody Weatherill as Rebby, and of course, Majel Barrett as the computer voice. Gino has the very sassy notes this week, I know because I looked at them before the show. So Gino, whenever you're ready, take us into Imperfection.
Imperfection! Well, why don't we get started right away, because our episode opens with a send-off for the Borg children minus Icheb. It appears that the writers knew they weren't going to do anything with these characters here in the last season, so they said, let's get rid of them. Mazzotti decides to give Seven a traditional goodbye, a hug, and the two boys follow. As they transport away, Seven appears distressed. She mentions to Icheb that they should deactivate the extra alcoves when he notices something. She's crying. She's a tough girl, blames it on her ocular implant, and goes about her day. And that's our opener.
So, yeah, we've cut off three of the Borg children, and now we're left with only Icheb. So what did you think of this, Gino? You've never seen this before.
Oh, look, we're getting rid of these kids. Great. Like, it's obvious. I mean, they didn't give him any sort of lead-up to the send-off. It's the very start of the episode. It's a bittersweet moment that we say goodbye, but for a good reason, blah, blah, blah. Basically, get rid of the kids. All right, well, Icheb's still here.
Well, the thing is, too, I mean, it is discharging them pretty quickly, but I think it's pretty smart that if you know that you're not going to do anything with them, if you have this whole last season to wrap up the show and you're not going to do anything with them, let's just get them out of the picture as quickly as possible. So I think this is efficient, if nothing else.
I think it would have been nice, though, if they had used the Mazzotti character a little bit more. She would have been fun, I think, in relationship with Naomi.
Oh, yeah, Wildman. She's a good actress. I think we talked about that when we first saw her, but they just decided that, you know, it wasn't worth the effort, I guess. More Harry Kim episodes!
I think they've got a bit too much like Full House, probably.
You mean like sitcoms do, where they decide to have the baby, and then they realize they don't want to do a bunch of baby episodes, so they make them all grown up the next season?
You got it, dude. So, the doctor examines Seven, telling her that emotions are okay.
Seems I owe you an apology. According to this, your tears were the result of a glitch in your primary cortical node. Have you experienced any other malfunctions lately? Headache, dizziness, diminished motor function?
No.
Really? Then you won't mind if I check the biomonitors in your alcove, just to be sure.
I've experienced an occasional headache.
Why didn't you come to see me?
The malfunctions have not affected my work.
Seven, if you're having problems, you need to let me know.
If it'll make you feel better, I'll be more forthcoming in the future.
You're all heart. I'll schedule some follow-up tests and make my report to the captain.
I prefer to keep this between us. I don't want to worry the captain.
We've always kept her informed of your medical needs.
It was my understanding that all members of this crew have the right to doctor-patient confidentiality.
If you want to keep this between us, that's where it'll stay.
Have you finished charting the nebula in Sector 949?
Several hours ago. I've been thinking. While I'm grateful for the opportunity to assist you in astrometrics, I'd like to take on more challenging assignments.
I can assign you additional diagnostics.
That's not what I meant. I want to work on the bridge.
You don't have the proper training.
That's why I'd like to take the entrance exam for Starfleet Academy. I could forward it to Earth in the next data stream transmission. If I pass, I could take the basic classes from Commander Tuvok. He was an instructor at the Academy.
Your plan is ambitious.
Then you think it's a good idea. You could take the classes with me. Earn your own commission.
I believe I've already assimilated enough Starfleet training.
I'll need a letter of recommendation from the captain.
I'll speak to her.
I'm okay with this. I mean, like, they're giving... If the point of getting rid of the Borg children is to keep him on board, they got to give him some kind of subplot. This will actually run through this last season every now and then.
Okay. True. You know, I always think that his relationship with Seven seems a little bit confusing. Like... I mean, you know, sometimes you get this vibe that he's like the little brother or the son or, I don't know. And I guess as we go through the season, I think they're still just trying to figure out what that relationship is supposed to be between the two of them.
I think they're mentor apprentice, but
yeah,
I don't know how well they pull it off in this episode. I mean, they definitely laid the groundwork for it though.
Sure.
I think they pull it off pretty well in this episode, kind of showing my hand a bit early here, but I like the chemistry that they got.
Well, I think that even though we've got a Seven Icheb kind of thing going on here, I really think we should pull in a ringer because we have the opportunity. So, hello, Manu!
Hey, guys. What's up?
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yes. Listeners, Manu and Teremi. Manu, listeners.
Hey, listeners. What's happening?
So, you've been on the show before. You know myself, Ben, and Melissa. Matt wasn't here last time you were on the show, so Matt is our resident brain. The rest of the three of us just share a collective bottle.
Okay, and you are the gentleman that has never seen that this is...
Correct.
...the first time you're watching, right?
But I wouldn't right. call myself right. a gentleman, per se.
Well, I wouldn't normally use that word either.
Yeah, and now that we're back to recording at night, Gino does occasionally have connection issues.
Meaning the drinks.
Yes.
It's raining in L.A., so I could totally fry out here at any time, too.
All right, cool. You know, it gets a little windy here and internet shuts down, so what are you going to do?
Yeah.
So, as we're going to get right back into the episode here, for the sake of those listeners who have time to really get things going. So, where we're at right now is that Icheb has presented to Seven that he would like to take the entrance exams to Starfleet. At this point, something begins to crawl under Seven's skin, and she excuses herself.
So, was this your idea to join Starfleet, Manu?
No, you know, some writer's idea. I was just glad this, you know, they were keeping me around. I think when I came on, you guys were mentioning if they're going to lose the kids, at least they can keep a storyline, and I was just lucky to...
Right, and we just mentioned earlier, they just booted the other three kids right at the start of this episode.
Yeah, it was really sad. It was a sad day on the set because, you know, it was the beginning of the first episode, I believe, that we all did in Season 7. And so, you know, there we were all back. You know, maybe this, you know, the last 3 or 4 months of season 6, we'd developed a relationship and a family, and we were back to shoot the first episode, thinking we'd all be on the last season, and they were all getting sent home. So it was definitely a, you know, sad last day for all those kids.
Now, from what I've heard, the crew used to all, well, the cast used to all get together and, like, give a gift to the crew at the end of every season that was, like, kind of an in-joke. Were you part of that?
No. No, I've become more part of a crew, you know, the years since the show has ended, since I was on. No, I never got any of the gifts. Not that I remember, but, you know, my brain is so haywire that I could be totally lying and someone will call me out on it later.
You're wearing the shirt right now, come on.
Yeah. I remember a set gift, but I don't remember it being an in-joke. I just remember it being like something, a Starfleet cup or something. I don't remember.
Nice. All right, well, Seven hooks herself into an alcove in the cargo bay, and she is unable to regenerate. Her cortical node is malfunctioning. Oh, sad day, huh? Okay, problems, but was it a little strange to anybody else that the computer pretty much, like, spoke to her directly? It's like, look, your cortical node is malfunctioning. That's what's wrong with you. Maybe yeah, it was me.
No, I'm with you there. I mean, she wouldn't take the doctor's advice, right? Mm-hmm. And, I mean, he approached her wrong, of course. He approached her with, you know, you're turning more human, and got proven wrong.
Actually, so the doctor hasn't worked on her yet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, no, but he did tell her when they first met in sickbay about the scene where she cries. He says it's perfectly natural.
Yeah, we're not there yet.
Oh, no, we're not there yet.
No, we did. We're there. If I look back two sentences in my notes, we've been there.
Yeah, we've been there. So you know, I mean, that's an interest. That relationship, that's kind of where it goes. You know, she rejects his advice because she thinks she surpassed him as a mentor now. But, you know, even though then it's mostly just exposition to get us into a crisis point that allows us to give Seven a new relationship. You know what I'm saying? I mean, they kind of laid the groundwork early in the episode by putting her with Egypt and having him have, you know, goals and desires, also showing his skills, you know, that he's already obtained. I think by this point, what's that?
Speaking of Egypt growing, I want to talk about physically. From the last main episode we actually had you on, Manu, to now, I think you had, like, grown, like, almost a foot. Like,
yeah, probably.
You were taller than Jerry Ryan at this point. Just barely, but, like, you could see the difference already.
I think you're hallucinating.
That could be it. That could very well be it. The absinthe is strong tonight.
Yeah.
So one thing I've noticed about her before, and I noticed it more later in the episode, but I definitely wanted to ask you about it. She's having a conversation with you. Like, the two of you are speaking face-to-face. And whenever Jerry Ryan would talk, she kind of, like, tilted her head a little bit. Mm-hmm. Is it just the way I look at things, or was she actually doing that?
I don't remember the Jerry Ryan head tilt. You know, when I watch other actors, I'm always stealing from them. I remember she always did that eyebrow thing. She would always cock that left eyebrow. And so maybe in order for her to do that, she had to give me a little head tilt to get that eyebrow to pop. I mean, thinking back, sure, it's been so long, but, you know, you gotta kind of turn the head a little bit to get that eyebrow, that Star Trek eyebrow. Everybody does it. It's the whole, it's the whole, like, we're in space eyebrow pop, you know? Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah. In fact, like, anytime anything happens in Star Trek, you had to, like, stand up, turn, and eyebrow pop.
Yeah.
Eyebrow pop.
That's kind of what everybody did. That's the whole sci-fi look in general.
In some circles, that's probably called the Nimoy.
Yeah, the Nimoy. You know, turn to camera and look very interested and concerned and pop that eyebrow. That's like, you see characters do that all the time. We all did that.
Yeah. All right, so Neelix enters the mess hall. Seven's been there all night long. She's been drinking protein shakes, and Neelix offers her an omelet. She refuses and collapses into convulsions. She wakes in sickbay to Janeway and the doctor explaining that her body is rejecting her implants. Unfortunately, these implants are vital and cannot be removed. In the collective, however, the Borg would simply replace the node, which gives Janeway an idea. She goes to the bridge, asks about a Borg debris field they recently passed. Chakotay mentions that if they're not careful, they could all end up with cortical nodes. I thought that was kind of a nice little line for Chakotay. Yes. He didn't seem to have much. But it's good that he can get a zinger in like that. So Paris and Tuvok invite themselves along, noting that last time she flew the Delta Flyer, she blew it into bits, and they're on their way.
So we have decidedly Kirk Janeway this week.
Yeah, oh, it's totally Kirk Janeway. She's like, I don't care what else is happening. Yeah, we just had a situation with the Borg like 2 or 3 weeks ago that they were going to assimilate everybody and we're all terrified of the Borg, but now, whatever. It's the Borg. Let's go walk onto a cube.
Hey, that's her baby, man.
That's true. She's just barreling in. I didn't want to deal with doing the math, but like they're going to slow down the ship so the Delta Flyer can fly in the opposite direction a couple of days.
Yeah, most likely. Yeah. I think if you, I mean, in my world.
Yeah. Because, you know, I mean, this is nitpickiness, but the debris field was a couple of days ago. She says we passed it like 5 or 6 days ago. Now, the Delta Flyer is warp capable, sure. So they're just like, slow down Voyager, warp out to the field, warp back, no big deal.
Yeah, that's my guess. I mean, you know what? You could cruise along at a steady speed if they're both warp capable.
Yeah.
So, you know, but I would think that the Voyager, just for, you know, purposes of protecting its own, what's the Delta called? It's like a transport ship, whatever.
Yeah, it's not exactly a shuttle.
Yeah, but for the purposes of protecting your smaller ship, I would think you would stop.
Yeah. Just, okay. Yeah.
Right.
And then sort of hang out.
I mean, that's the only
Delta Flyer got blown up, though.
Yeah. Well, this is the built the new one.
When?
In between episodes.
Oh, you can build a new flyer. I mean, come on, we got lots of people on the ship that build new flyers.
Well, they built the first one pretty easily. So.
Yeah, and that one was only when they had one Borg. This time they had two, you know, capable Borg on the ship.
It was, by the way, Matt, I want to point out on the new Delta Flyer, you know, Delta Flyer Beta, Tom likes the joysticks on this one. He was playing with them the whole episode.
Yeah, he put in his Captain Proton control panel again.
Yeah, I like it. Like
I was really excited to fly that thing, too. Not that to give anything away, but
what?
One time.
Yeah. Actually, that's coming up later this season.
Oh, man. So excited.
That was the funnest part of the whole experience, you know, getting to play with the keyboards your own way and fly the joysticks.
Yeah.
And it was really, it's really terrible, too, because I'm sure it would be a fun thing. Maybe you guys have done it, but just to go back through the episodes and watch how everybody else flies it compared to others. I'm sure we all do our own thing that's completely nonsensical.
Well, the thing that I noticed really is when Kate Mulgrew flies the Delta Flyer, she loves playing with the old-fashioned controls that he has installed on the right side of the pilot seat. So
like a little throttle kind of gear thing?
Yeah, she loves, whenever she's in the pilot seat, she always uses that control panel at some point.
There was a joystick, too. She just loves flicking that knob.
Yeah, I did too. I remember there was like an asteroid coming, and I like you know tried to veer out of the way with one and pull down with the other or something like that. I don't know.
So Icheb stops the captain on her way out.
Captain,
I'll meet you in the shuttle bay.
Have you talked to Seven?
Just a few minutes ago.
Then you don't approve.
Of what?
My request.
Request?
I'm sure Seven will discuss it with you when she has the chance. I'm sorry I bothered you.
Obviously no one's told you.
Told me what?
Seven isn't well.
What's wrong with her?
Her cortical node is failing.
Her cortical node? She's going to die.
Not if we find a new node. We're on our way to search a Borg debris field.
I have experience in Borg technology. Let me come with you.
I appreciate the offer, but it's too dangerous.
I'm willing to take the risk.
I'm not willing to let you. I'll let you know how we did as soon as we're back. Don't worry.
Seven?
Why are you here?
The captain told me you were ill.
I'm fine.
Then why are you in sick bay?
That's not your concern. You have work to complete. Report to Astrometrics.
I finished my work.
Then I'll assign you more.
Is there a problem?
I wish to be alone.
Come with me, please.
Why is she so angry with me?
She's not angry with you. She's just angry.
I don't understand.
It's a common response to serious illness. She's frustrated to be confined, embarrassed to appear vulnerable.
She shouldn't be embarrassed in front of me. I'm her friend.
And her pupil. She doesn't want you or anyone else to see her when she's not at her best.
It's not her fault that she's sick.
Of course not. But we have to allow her to deal with this in her own way, with as much dignity as possible. Give her time. She may decide she wants company, and if she does, you're the first person I'll call.
You know, listening to that, it's so funny, man. I'm such a kid. I mean, I'm 21, but I'm such a kid. You know, the acting is I'm always really, all in all, really solidly proud of the work I did on that show, but just listening to that, I'm so much better now.
Oh, but man, even this episode, like, I'm not sure about much of a difference between the last episode and now, but this episode is really impressive, just showing off how you nailed this character.
Yeah.
I don't mean to blow smoke up your apron here, but definitely we always talk about how much Robert Picardo really steals the scene. And you two, just head-to-head every time you were on screen, like, he did not step over you one bit.
No, I love Picardo, man. And, you know, I think I said this last time, but the when we did this episode and a later scene towards the end where we have that showdown, he said to me, you know, sometimes we've got a guest star actor that comes on this show and sort of wakes up the rest of the crew. And from that day forward, I've been good friends with the man. And, we're probably going to go make two films together in the next 4 months. And
man,
I just always wanted to repay him for, you know, I was a young kid and I didn't have a whole lot of experience and a whole lot of acting is all about making confident choices and just getting that talented actor's approval at that young age of my skills, I don't know, did a whole lot for me career-wise all the way down till now, you know. So I love that man. He's the man.
That's awesome. And
you can see him. He's just getting it out. You know, he's been doing the show for 7 seasons. He's just on his mark, nailing it every time. I don't think he ever did more than 1 or 2 takes, and he was gone. It was just good stuff.
Good thing he didn't play a character that had to wear a lot of makeup.
Yeah.
Or was that a bald cap?
I think Picardo came out bald.
All right, so the Delta Flyer reaches the debris field, and they find approximately 37 drones. I say approximately because, you know, Tuvok says it, and then Paris says, you know, that sounds really approximate. And that little bit reminded me, this whole episode is full of zingers like that. Like, is this a specific writer that, like, really had his hand on the pulse of this episode, or were they really just trying to push comedy a little bit more out of this show? Because we've mentioned before that Voyager's a comedy, but this is really, like, comedic, even though it's playing a serious angle here.
I mean, I took it as sort of like the comic relief in between scenes, only because this is a heavy episode. This is someone accepting their possible death. So, you know, they're going to do a couple things to lighten the mood, but I'm glad it doesn't last too long, because if it had been more comedic, it just would have felt out of place and taken away from the dramatic impact of the show.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think they lighten it up just enough. I remember reading this episode, and I was 21, and I'd done some other things in Hollywood, but I remember reading it and being really affected by it, being that it was an episode that was metaphorically about, you know, giving up your kidney for someone else, or, you know, what you would do for a family friend, brother, sister. And
absolutely.
I remember just, you know, calling my mother, and, you know, don't mean to toot my own horn on my empathy or sensitivity, but I literally was crying, you know, saying, Mom, I'm finally going to get a chance to do some work that's going to affect people. And, you know, I'm really, really proud of this episode, and having gone around to cons and stuff and around the world, and I've had a couple people say some really heavy things to me on stage in Germany. Maybe 3 years after the show was over, this guy stood up and said, hey, I wanted to thank you for Imperfection. My brother was getting his kidney transplanted, and that episode really brought us closer together and helped him get through it. And then his brother was next to him and stood up next to him, and they were both, you know, TV doesn't change the world that much or anything, but for me, that was like full circle when those guys said that to me, I just lost it on stage. I just started bawling in front of like 5,000 people at this Termin Con because it was so touching. And so those guys, I emotionally impacted them with the art of the show, and they in turn stood up and emotionally rocked me back. And so like that was the magic that an actor looks for in Hollywood, you know, to get those experiences. So really, I don't know. Go off on a tangent there, but I'm so proud.
No, that's a great story.
Please do, absolutely. I mean, this is why I'm overjoyed that we could get you on this show. I mean, myself personally, I was moved watching this episode.
Me too.
Not to spoil my final rating, but to have you here and talk to you about that, that's so cool.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a total cheeseball. I'm tearing up a little bit now just even talking about it. You know, it's like, really proud of this. The writing on everything about this, just getting this the chance to make this episode, I was, you know, thankful.
Yeah, I don't mind spoiling my thoughts up front. This is by far my favorite episode with your character in it. And the fact that, like Gino said earlier, you know, you went toe-to-toe with Picardo. Actually, in this episode, if you think about it, guys, he went toe-to-toe with all the heavy hitters of the show, the three big ones, Picardo, yeah. Mulgrew, and Ryan. And he managed to, you did phenomenally in every scene. So.
Every time.
Thank you. You know, if you have any talent acting at all, working with actors that talented does nothing but bring it out. So, you know, those guys taught me so much and still do.
Yeah, I've watched that before.
I'm watching Kate on Orange is the New Black, and she's amazing, man. I love all those actors.
So, back to the episode.
Yeah.
Janeway and Tuvok beam over and remove a drone's Corkle node. Just as they remove the node, some guys beam in and claim the whole area as their own. I say some guys because we never get a name, we never get a race, nothing.
I don't know about you guys, but to me, when I saw this guy pop up, I'm going to cuss a little bit here, but it's not too bad. This guy, these aliens look like the bastard love children of Klingons and Kazon.
Okay.
I knew you were going to say that.
All right. So just as they remove the node, these guys show up, claim the whole area as their own. Janeway diplomatically holds a laser scalpel to the main guy's throat. Tuvok takes a couple down, pauses, waits for the other to fire at him. Just before it gets worse, Paris beams him out. Paris and Janeway take. Paris has Janeway take tactical, and they land a successful hit on the enemy ship. This concludes our interaction with the alien of the week.
And it also concludes our phaser fight quota for the week, because most of the time, especially these later season Voyagers, that's how the episodes end, is the battle of the week. And I'm so glad that this happens now, because the ending is so much more powerful than any sort of phaser battle could have given, in my opinion at least.
Oh, sure.
I want to point out a difference between this episode, just right here, and the one we reviewed earlier with Manu. And the difference is, you know, one of our biggest complaints was just what you said, Matt. They ended it with all the drama of the episode. They ended it with the phaser fight. And here they use the phaser fight to intensify the drama, which is nice. I really do like it. And I do agree with all of you guys. The acting, writing is very good. But I want to point out something, like, mildly negative, just about the, like, show itself.
Oh, here we go.
No, it's okay. It's not a big deal, but it's just that, and it's not really my criticism. It's just I want to address it because it needs addressing. It's season 7, and you know now we're amongst the Borg again, and I'd like the Borg, and I'm always okay with seeing and exploring their ships and whatnot. But this is the sort of stuff that people say was the downfall of this season, and they start with it right up front. You know, the ability to access the Borg, the most, you know, villainous, mysterious people here, and now they have the covers right off of them, you know, so that they're naked and open. And I think that's a little disappointing for some people, as they especially see the beginning of the season go from here on out. But I just wanted to at least be fair to that aspect of.
You know, I think you could write that off as it's a debris field. You know, the Borg don't even care about this cube right now. And I think they wanted to throw us for a loop, because I could definitely see them saying, oh no, the Borg have showed up and we gotta, you know, get our way out of it. But it's very possible that if they showed up and we got away, they would pursue. But if it was some random alien group that showed up and said, this place is ours, they're not going to chase.
Yeah, no, I mean, they do exactly what they're supposed to do with it. It's just that the more you're exposed to something, the less interested you are in it.
Exactly.
And that's always dangerous to run that line with characters and villains and story mm-hmm. threads and all those things like that. A little bit too much familiarity is it. And, I mean, I think in the end, you know, there's just some certain choices that they made where are very polarizing to the fans. I'm actually on the, like, let's go have fun, so I love it. But I have to be fair to staff and address them ahead of time.
I didn't quite get the whole point of the conversation. You mean that some of the fan base thinks that they looked at the Borg too much this season?
Yeah. That's a general criticism. You know, if you could, you know how the people knock the UN for being a toothless tiger? They kind of come at the Borg, the species, the villainous race, in the same fashion.
Okay.
I think it's fine because I like you know, I'm a guy, I like, you know, bang bang shoot 'em up sometimes.
Yeah, I like bang bang shoot 'em up all the time.
That's right.
You know, I'm a fan of the new films because they're all bang bang shoot 'em up, and there's still some drama going on in there, but they're so high intensity, high paced, and my favorite film before this, before the new films was First Contact. So I like the Borg in general, and
yep.
I'm down to see as much of them as they want to show us. And I really like watching that little cortical node pop out of those guys' heads. I thought that was kind of a cool effect.
Okay, I had to ask you about that. We're not there yet, but since you brought it up, I wanted to ask about it. So during the surgery scene, like, did they just, like, put a little green dot on your head and decide to, like, green screen that in? Or, like, I mean, how do you do that? How do you film pulling a metal thing out of somebody's forehead?
You know, from what I remember, absolutely nothing. There was no green dot. There was no... I mean, I might have had my eyes closed, so they might have put that little silver ball in there that they can draw over. But from what I remember, they just did it. You know? I wasn't, you know, I'm not a visual effects wizard. I mean, I know these days, is, you know, the little I know about how it's done as a producer, you know, I leave that up to my visual effects guys, but I thought you'd have to put a green screen in there or something besides my forehead to draw over from, but from what I remember, they didn't do anything. It just...
Yeah, because you're going over a couple different colored surfaces with that there. I mean, that's... Oh. If that's CGI, it looked great.
Yeah, it is. There's no prosthesis, anything going on in there. It was just my forehead and Picardo, you know, putting his little tweezers over there and faking it, and they did the rest.
Okay. I think the sound really sold it too. Just the little
The sound. Ding.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's so good. Okay, so
and then Picardo's got his little tweezers too, and he's like slowly, carefully, and you know
I wonder how much operation you have to play to prepare for that one scene.
That's what I was thinking during that scene.
So, in sickbay, Seven just can't stay in bed. The doctor says she should be resting, and Neelix brings her some flowers and a Cadascot board. She doesn't want the company. The doctor explains to Neelix that Seven is much too weak to play, and that Neelix would easily beat her. But she just can't resist reverse psychology. Just then, Janeway contacts the doctor with news of the new cortical node. So, I don't know. Reverse psychology?
I like that. I think so. Seven, we've seen over the season, she's got a big illegal, even if she doesn't want to admit it. So, of course...
Seeing Seven get screwed around with, man.
Right?
That's just cute. They're just going for more cute to separate the heavy scenes, and they find a little cute with Neelix.
They usually do.
You're right. You know, this is a really heavy episode, and they try to keep it lighthearted until it gets super heavy. Mm. But I could see it just being a sob fest if they didn't put those little notes in there.
Yeah. And you could point out too how far the character, you know, since we're at the first episode of season 7 and all, it should be noted that if you look at how far along the character Neelix has come from start to finish. It's undeniable. Not only his use in the his use as a character, like within writing and doing just what you're saying by breaking up heavy scenes like this, but also, you know, everything else he brings. So I think that's a good thing to point out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I mean, I love seeing Neelix start off in season 1 where he's basically like, screw these guys. Captain Janeway's an idiot. He wants to abandon ship like in episode 5. And now he's the counselor / morale officer. So great evolution there. Please, Manu, continue.
Yeah. I don't like nitpicking because the biggest problem that I have with the Star Trek fan base in general is they say more and more Star Trek. We want to see more. And then when it comes out, they bash it. And I hate that. So I hate... I hate even nitpicking anything when it comes to, like, you know, this is a $3 million budget
right.
series. You know, of course, maybe if I was there controlling things, I may have done something differently, but I just like appreciating it for what it is. And but anyway, I'm going to nitpick anyway. If I were to nitpick...
You're guilty, too.
Everyone's guilty, right? We're all sinners. You know, I think the biggest flaw with Neelix is I love that guy. His face in general is so funny, and his personality is so funny. For me, it's the heavy makeup took away from the ability of Ethan Phillips to make us love him. And they learned that mistake into the next series with Dr. Phlox by making his makeup lighter.
Yeah. Oh, Ethan Phillips is a riot. I mean, anything
Ethan
I've seen
Phillips
him in.
Ethan Phillips is really great, but with those eyes and all that teeth and all that crazy hair and that double sweater vest and everything.
It's the forehead, too, that doesn't let you really see him emote. It's
that
prosthesis on his forehead.
They really took away his ability to be... as magic and as cute and as fun as he is, without all that heavy makeup, that's my one nitpick. He would have been so much better if they would have just had a little less... less alien on him.
I can see where you're coming from, but the thing that I think helps it, at least partially, is that Ethan Phillips, at least through his performance here, he's got such a big personality that always manages to shine through even beyond, under all that those prostheses.
And somehow the guy sat in that chair every day for 4 hours to get that stuff on and kept a good attitude on. But, you know, if I was doing that show with my stupid ego, and by season 3 I'd have been just like a grumpy prick until the camera turned on, and really good guys. So.
All right, well, the new cortical node has arrived, so they get to work right away. And upon replacing the node, Seven's implants reject the new node. She dies on the operating table. In her depression, Janeway flies the ship into the nearest asteroid. End of series.
Kidding.
It was all a simulation. But sadly, all the simulations have failed. This node won't work. They need one from a live drone. And it looks like Janeway isn't afraid of the Borg once more, because the Doctor explains they might not have a way to save her. We've gone a little back and forth on how Janeway looks at the Borg, but she's really willing to do anything here. And I think we're starting to get into the meat of the episode right here, because we get a heavy note with the Doctor explaining to Janeway, look, we might have to accept the fact that Seven's going to die. It's very unlikely that we'll get a live Borg out here, just run into them, and then get away with one cortical node. So, problems, I don't know. Neelix is keeping Seven company with Kataskot. Seven steamrolls him, and the Doctor and Janeway enter. They explain the situation and tell her that she shouldn't give up hope. The Doctor needs to monitor her condition, so she can't even go back to work. Things are starting to snowball right now.
Right.
So Seven can't go back to her normal job. She wants to do everything she does in life, just keep herself busy, and it's not going to happen.
And the thing I like with Janeway, especially this storyline that's starting for her here, is that you and I know, Gino, from watching the show, that this is Captain Never Say Die. So, you know, she's always been so stubborn and very headstrong and very, like, going to go against all odds to accomplish her goal. And this is the one time she has to face facts that she may not be able to do that this week. And you see that's really hard for her.
Well, I mean, hard for her character, but of course Jeri Ryan's going to nail that sad face every time.
Well, no, I'm talking about also to Kate Mulgrew, because like I said, Janeway's always used to accomplishing and saving the day.
Right.
So this may be one time where she's powerless to do that, and you see that in her, you know, in her facial expressions, and I really appreciated that.
Yeah, right. I can see it in my head too. Yeah, I remember that worried look.
So Icheb enters sickbay to find it empty, and here's where we start getting a lot more Icheb in this episode. And he reactivates the EMH, who's mid sentence. Of course, another good CGI bit right here. We don't usually see the EMH activate mid-sentence. You know, he's always, please state the nature of the medical emergency, but like, boom, he's right into it. So, I guess it wouldn't be too difficult to film this bit. I'm going to get kind of behind the scenes-y here, because we've got you on board here, Mono. Yeah. So I guess he would just walk into the room and they just cut him in at some point?
Yeah, basically with the little whatever little effect they did. I remember saying the line to an empty room, and then when they brought him into the two shot, he just walked in, and his first line is "Horse to sedate you." Oh, excuse me, Jeff.
So good.
Basically, the same thing as beaming out. Just walk off camera, walk back on, and they run a little tape, and there you are. Put an effect over it. You know, that was one of the biggest bummers. I was like, I'm getting beamed up. This is so rad. Cut. Walk away. Action. Okay, you're done. But then when you get to finally see it, it's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
But I like that little moment too, and I also love that. I'm a big fan of just beautiful camera work, and when Ichab walks into that room, there's that great little camera drift on the dolly and the slide where you kind of zoom around him a little bit as he gets to look around. I love when the camera does that drift, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned it last time, too, how the sick bay seemed the most spaceship-ish of any other set. I guess they really wanted to take every opportunity they could to really show off their most intricate set.
Yeah, they get the little 360 camera effect in there to make it seem bigger and spacier and fun. And it's that double room also with the doctor's quarters. I really loved working on that set.
And I listened to the last time. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to be on the last episode that you were on, but I listened to you last time talk about how it was an experience working with different writers and directors from week to week. And you mentioned the camera work this week, which I think is really impressive. And this episode was directed by David Livingston. So do you have any memories about working with him on this episode and what kind of director he was?
Livingston wasn't a very acting-friendly director. And all the actors, well, not all of the actors, I don't remember who, but I remember a lot of people going, oh, man, it's Livingston. We're going to shoot and shoot and shoot and shoot. But I think it pays off because I think, he's about getting the shot. He wasn't really, everybody by that point knew what they were doing actor-wise. It's season 7. Everybody knows their character. He's so, like LeVar Burton would do a lot of, coming in there and what's going on in the scene, emotional actor stuff. Livingston would just let us go and then cover it from a million different angles. And overshoot. Everyone was like, oh, it's a Livingston episode. We're going to be here till 4 in the morning. but I was a kid then, so everything I was hearing was like, who knows? Now I like directors to work me and overshoot and get everything they can because then you definitely get some magic.
At the time, out of the episodes that you were on, was there a director that you liked working with most out of the revolving door that you had to work with?
I worked with LeVar, I think, 3 times, maybe. So I got a sort of comfort level with him. But the show was such a smooth-running machine in all facets, and everybody was so close, especially, I came on the last 2 seasons, so it was such a tight-knit family. And it wasn't, I don't think I have a favorite. It just all ran so smoothly. It was just a pleasure to work on a show that went off without a hitch.
Man, I gotta say, I'm doing a really good job of not nerding out right now. For somebody to say, I got a really good relationship with LeVar Burton, whatever. I worked side by side with these people almost every day. Big deal. Ugh.
It's funny, man. LeVar, I'll share something with you about LeVar. He'll probably kick my ass if he ever hears it. But he's a really uptight guy off the set. Like on the set, he was really, really friendly with me. And like off the set, I don't know him very well, but I bumped into him a few times and we've hied and bied. But I remember when I met him the very first time I got to set and he was directing an episode, I knew his work from Reading Rainbow. Which is funny because it turns out now he did this whole Reading Rainbow thing and raised all this millions of dollars.
Right.
Rainbow again. But I walked up to him then, and he carries a big chip on his shoulder about being a black man in America. And I can relate to that. It's hard being a black man in America, but he's always really carrying it and preaching it, heavy. So the first time I meet him, I go, hey, man, I just want to say thank you for, when I was a kid, that show really affected me. I started to read The Hobbit, and, I started reading books because of you in a big way. So thanks for sparking my imagination and blah, blah, blah. And he was grumpy and, dealing with something in the episode. Who knows what he was dealing with? But he turns and he goes, dude, have you even seen Roots? He's like, you're thanking me for reading Rainbow. Have you seen Roots? And I'm like, Roots? No, Roots. What's Roots? And it pissed him off. And he goes, Kunta Kinte? You ever heard of Kunta Kinte? And I was like, no. Should I see it? I guess I will. I'll see it. You know, so I just, and I think he even used like a cuss word when it was like, have you even seen Roots? And I was just, it was like, I stepped back, you know, I was like, I'm sorry, man. I was trying to just say thanks. But for anybody approaching an actor at any time, this is what I've learned in, you know, 20 years of this business. We get approached that way so often that if anybody ever bites your head off for coming up and saying, hey, man, thanks for this and all that, it's just not the way to approach an actor. If you've seen an actor in the supermarket, think of something more clever than, hey, thanks for, hey, Clint Eastwood, thanks for The Good, Bad, and the Ugly, man. That was awesome. You know, it's like, oh, shut up already.
So how many times have you been told people thought you'd be taller?
None. Really? You might be the first one. I'm 6 foot, so.
Okay.
Much taller could I be?
Exactly how much alcohol did you consume while you were watching this episode? Because I didn't notice it.
I've had all of it.
All of it.
I hear that's a common complaint to actors. You know, people would say, oh, I thought you'd be taller. It's just this misconception we get of seeing people on screen. You know, you're 10 foot tall and solid gold, man.
Yeah, well, that's because so many superstars, for some reason, and I don't know why, are short guys. You got Aaron Paul, you got, you know, Tom Cruise, who's like 5'4 or whatever.
Schwarzenegger's short.
Schwarzenegger's a little guy. I mean, he's a big guy, but he's a tall guy.
But when they put Arnold Schwarzenegger next to Danny DeVito, he looks like he's about 7.5 feet tall.
Sure.
Yeah, and Danny DeVito's there's just so many little teeny actors that they actually even go out of their way to stand on apple boxes and have them walk up fake ramps to make look bigger. I'm not one of those guys. I'm 6 foot, so.
All right.
People, you know, see me and go, oh, he's about what I expected.
Well, coming up, correct me if I'm wrong, Gino, but in the episode where we are right now, we're about to come up on both Roxanne's and Manu's really tour de force in this episode.
Yes, we're just there because Seven has run off. She's left her comm badge in sickbay, and of all the people to be harboring a fugitive on this ship, B'Elanna is holding on to Seven.
He's looking for you. The doctor. I ran into him in the corridor. He's about 30 seconds away from calling a ship-wide alert.
Are you going to tell him where I am?
Nope. I know what it's like to be stuck in sick bay. I've escaped the doctor myself once or twice.
Thank you.
Anytime.
Lieutenant. When you die, do you believe your spirit will go to Stovacor?
You shouldn't be thinking about dying.
According to the doctor's simulations, any attempt to adapt the salvage node will fail. Stovacor, Lieutenant. Do you believe you'll go there?
I guess it all depends on how honorable my death is.
But you do believe there's something after death?
I hope so. What about you?
The Borg have no concept of an afterlife. However, when a drone is deactivated, its memories continue to reside in the collective's consciousness. As long as the Hive exists, so will a part of that drone.
You don't seem to take much comfort in that.
My link to the collective has been severed for nearly 4 years. If I die, everything that I've accomplished in that time, everything I achieved as an individual, will be lost. My memories, my experiences. It will be as if I never existed.
I think you're a little more memorable than you're giving yourself credit for. You don't need the collective to validate your existence. You've made an impact on every member of this crew. That's your legacy.
That's such good writing.
Jeez. Oh, man.
God, that's good.
Now, Ben, I know you're someone who is more into story rather than character arcs, but I feel like I really wanted to pull that clip because so much is going on in this scene. First of all, you have Jeri Ryan going through the five stages of grief in accepting her, you know, what she thinks is going to be her inevitable death, which is fantastic to watch. But this is for any of the fans who know what the Seven B'Elanna relationship has been like since Seven came on the show, this is a big step for this relationship. Because we've never seen it taken to this level of compassion between these two.
Yeah,
and how about the metaphor for a new god, even, man, from these, you know, sci-fi writers who, for the most part, aren't Christian.
Yeah,
going in, you know, we're all a part of each other's afterlife, whether you're hooked up to a computer or not. We reside in each other's memory and in each other's souls. That's some heavy stuff, man. And
you know, and they're real subtle about it too, just in that they tell us here, like you guys are talking about, but they also show us too. I mean, so forgive me, I'll do something I never do, but I'll spoil the rest. I mean, her each of giving himself a part of himself to her, you know, is metaphorically similar to Adam giving his rib to Eve, as you get. And I think that's really goes to show that anybody who sees an episode like this, like, you know, Matt brings me up because I don't like the characters that much. Well, true, that doesn't invest me in the story all that great. But, you know, the quality's still there. But I'm always invested in the writing, the meaning in the writing as well. And I think that does go to show, since you guys like the acting so much this time, just how excellent the writing of an episode like this is that can even keep somebody like me who really not invested in characters and what have you, you know, going through the entire episode. So I think that's quite nice.
Yeah, really good writing. Who wrote this episode? Anybody know?
I had it. Let's see. The story was by Andre Bormanis and the teleplay by Carlton Eastlake and Robert Dougherty.
Wow.
I'm remembering Dougherty, but I don't recognize those other two names for other
people. Still making Andre Bormanis writes a lot of Star Trek.
Who does?
Andre, I think it's
Bormanis.
Yeah,
and Doherty's been around too. Doherty's still making TV. I think Doherty's got Pretty Little Liars out. I think that's his show. Anyway, he's still around. He's a showrunner now.
So I'm going to go ahead and back up the nitpicking truck here.
Why?
Because Seven asks B'Elanna, she says, "So when you die, do you think you're going to go to Stovacor?" I kind of expected B'Elanna to be like, "Do you remember a couple episodes? Well, it was like a season ago when she woke up on the boat on the way to, like, Klingon Hell, and her mom was there."
Yeah, but nobody changes their mind straight away forever. I mean, we always...
I mean, you wake up on the boat. Come on. That's pretty solid proof to me.
Right, well, that's exactly... It might be proof, but proof only comes through experience. I mean, knowing something's different than experiencing it. They're quite clear in that episode as well that that's not necessarily exactly guaranteed to have been real and have occurred. It could have just been... It was something that she went through, you know, as a dream or something of that nature.
So you're telling me at the end of the season, JR is going to wake up and he wasn't even shot?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, possible.
If that's what happens, I'm going to be really disappointed, man.
Well, you know, that trick's already been pulled once.
Actually, I forgot to say, Gino, the end of Voyager is Janeway wakes up. Voyager hasn't even left the Alpha Quadrant yet. She's just getting to the ship on her first assignment. This whole series was a dream.
Need to go find a pilot. Let's go to the Starfleet prison. Oh, geez. Okay, so I think we have a clip after this, don't we?
We did, because I wanted, you know, that was, you know, Roxanne Dawson's big scene, and this is the big scene with Manu and Jeri having their confrontation, so.
Make it so.
Are you feeling better?
My condition is unchanged. I've spoken to the captain about your desire to apply to Starfleet Academy. She's agreed to administer the entrance exam before we send the next data stream to Earth. It's a list of crewmen who can help you study. Lieutenant Torres is extremely well-versed in warp mechanics. Ensign Kim claims to have aced the quantum theory section.
What about astrometrics?
You know more about astrometrics than most Starfleet officers.
Still, I'll need someone to review the material with me.
I'll ask Lieutenant Paris to set aside some time.
I'd rather study with you.
You've become too dependent on me. You must learn to rely on others.
And if I don't want to?
What you want is irrelevant.
Why are you acting like this? Is it because you think you're dying?
I am dying. I'm sorry.
You may have given up, but I haven't.
Great scene.
Wow.
I mean, I feel like that's one of those scenes, even if you nailed it, you'd kind of want to do it again, just because being in that moment is so cool. Like, the two of those characters going back and forth, I mean, you're in kind of like the dark cargo bay, so the whole room has the feel of the conversation you're having. This is the conversation I noticed the head tilt, by the way. She's really kind of giving you the...
I have no memory of the scene whatsoever, which means that's good. Anytime you're doing dramatic work that's this dramatic and you're kind of locked into the other actor's eyes and you're in the moment, usually when you come out of it and the scene's done and you're done covering it from all the angles they want it covered from, you don't remember being there if you did it well. So, thank God.
I'd say that's a good thing, yeah.
Yeah, for some reason it's this weird effect where, you know, you're acting, so you're trying to live outside of your real life in a completely false situation and convince yourself that it's happening. Somewhere in there, if you do it right, you completely blank out and you live in it, and thus your memory of it is more emotional than it is visual.
Okay,
that is a really cool explanation. I've never heard anyone put it that way before.
Yeah,
actors have the greatest ability to suspend disbelief of all of us. Pretend they make the world around them a pretend place.
And it's because, for me personally, I hate my freaking life. I can't stand and seriously, the only time that I'm happy in this world, and I found out from a very young age, is when those cameras are rolling and I'm getting to tell somebody else's story that is going to have an impact on the rest of humanity. Because for me, life in general, man, has been so hard, and I think it's hard for all of us. It's painful. It's a cold, hard earth that we all live on, and you know, we have periods of joy and periods of pain. But when I get to act, even though I'm living in somebody else's pain or somebody else's pleasure, it's a complete escapism thing for me, and I think it is for a lot of actors. You know, because then somehow I've convinced myself that by telling somebody else's story truthfully, that my life counts because I've, you know, it's the same thing as the earlier in the episode where you're talking about communal oneness of, you know, God or entity or collective. For me, you know, the humanity, I'm getting real freaking deep here, but humanity is it.
Please, you know, do. Go ahead.
Humanity, plants and ants and trees and all of it, you know, the whole thing, DNA is a collective. And, you know, the particular incarnation that I'm living in right now, I'm just more happy when I'm creatively making some sort of entertainment product that's going to make people think and feel than when I'm stuck in an apartment in Hollywood only being able to talk to one person. But when you make a movie, you get to talk to a million people and put out a vibe into that, you know, collective atmosphere. And then accept responsibility for whatever that message was that you decided to be a part of. So it's like I'm really blabbing here, but I did a war movie a few years ago that I had a real sort of tweaked out thing because it was called Fortress, and it was, you know, a lot of the movie is about brotherhood and peer pressure and guys getting each other to drink and to sacrifice their lives, and it kind of glorified war. And I fought this battle with, like, wow, did I really want to be a part of that project? Did I want to put that message out there? But then enough of it, because it was World War II, I convinced myself that, hey, that war was a war that needed to be fought, and the movie was also about brotherhood and about, you know, doing the right thing when there's too much evil in the world, and how much people will sacrifice for each other fighting a war that is of just cause. So, anyway, blah, blah, blah. Sorry to go off that far, but...
No, absolutely not, because we don't get this perspective at all on this show, so thank you for sharing all this with us.
Yeah, but yeah, it's a magic... It's just... It's definitely a gift, so anytime I get to get in front of the camera and tell a good story... By the way, guys, in a couple months, if you go to Roddenberry Entertainment, watch their short they're going to put up called Instant. It'll be probably free to download or a buck to download, hopefully free, because that's what they're talking about. Great 20-minute side, just you'll love it. Check out Instant in a couple months. I'm really proud of that work, too. Let's go back to the show.
So a little bit back to what you were talking about. I've never been on, you know, something like Star Trek Voyager or something as enormous as things you've been on, but being on a stage or in front of a camera myself, I can attest to that, and I'm sure most, if not all, of the acting community can agree with you there. That escapism, that being able to tell that other bit of story, that is a different kind of feeling than mostly anything else you'll ever experience. Because when it's over, when the scene is done, especially if you've done well, there's this feeling of completion and, I don't know, this acceptance, especially if you're working with a crew for a long time and, you know, you're kind of really revealing yourself in front of a lot of people. I mean, when it comes down to it, you've got everybody else that's on set with you, all the crew people, everybody else is just observing, and you're out there open, and all these people are accepting of you, you know, if you flub a line or just go back into it, and, you know, at the end of it, if you've got people saying, you know, that was great, you did a great job, I mean, there's no better way to shine somebody's ego than by being right there.
Yeah, and it's a really dangerous place to be, too, because... You know, everybody, I just did a dark romance, a romantic film that is just a beautiful movie about two people falling in love. That, and, you know, the whole crew for...
Oh, you've remade Romeo and Juliet?
Yes, yeah, of course. there's, you know, everybody's there on the set no matter what they are. The lighters, the gaffers, the grips, the makeup department, the actors, the director, the ADs, the wardrobe. Everybody's there so that you can... capture that one moment of reality that may, if it's done well, go out there, and it's a couple movie, right? It's made for people who are in love to go into a theater and appreciate that they have each other, or people that are single to go into a movie and go, man, I really want to go out there and find somebody, one or the other, you know? And you're right. Just that feeling of satisfaction when you get a scene and when you know you've shot a good film, it's not more about like people high fiving you, great job, but you do have that communal feeling of like, you know, film for me is, and television, and especially moral television like Star Trek. It's, you know, all the great arts stuck together. You can paint a canvas alone, but you can't do it with film. It's music, it's sound design, it's all the great arts. It's painting, canvas, writing, name an art, and it is film. So you've got every artist, architecture, set design, all that stuff, and you're all painting a canvas together, and so it's so difficult to do. Could you imagine, like, 50 painters choosing one canvas? And,
oh, man.
You know what I mean? So it's so... I've made so much crap in my history as an actor that whenever... You know, Voyager is like something I'm very proud of. Whenever something comes off well, it is such a rush and such a feeling of contentment.
Absolutely. So to put us back on rails, because I'm sure you want to hear about Star Trek, right, listeners?
Yeah.
Yay. So Icheb goes to the doctor and explains that he knows where they can get a node. His cortical node could be used, and because he emerged from his maturation chamber before fully assimilating, he has a good chance of surviving. The doctor protests, and Icheb has the numbers to back it up. So this is the real Robert Picardo and you scene that just really you guys butt heads and big personality. I mean, this is where a lesser actor would get steamrolled. And, I mean, you cut him off, you hand him that pad, you kind of, I really watched your character in this scene because I knew we were going to have you on the show. And, I mean, talk about standing up to a lion. I mean, this guy is coming at you and you just boom, boom, boom. And a lot of that is acting, some of it's directing, but, I mean, this scene really turned out really well.
Thank you. These are one of the scenes I'm not proud of, though. Like, I think I do get steamrolled in this scene. I think he smokes me. if I were to go back and reshoot this scene, I think the scene would be much stronger. 15 years down the line, of course it would. But I remember, you fake it as well as you can, especially when someone's pushing you like Picardo is. But I remember thinking that it's always no matter what any actor tells you, there's a few times when you're doing a scene with another actor that it's that you understand that this is their scene and you give way to them and you let them have their moment. But most of the time, 99% of the time, we're trying to steal each other's scenes. That's just the name of the game. And this one, he definitely smokes me, in my opinion. But
I think it fits because of how young the character is supposed to be at this point. It's kind of like a, listen here, son.
Yeah.
I mean, totally, like, standing up to it. Great scene. And the fact that he changes his mind at the end of the scene really kind of sells it.
Go ahead.
Sorry, but the other thing was there was a little bit of, like, triple pad passing back and forth in this.
Right.
And I used to be so bad with props that props would really throw me out of a scene, and I've gotten a lot better at that. But there was like three or four pads we were handing back and forth in this scene, and you don't have the beep, beep, beep on them, and you don't have any sort of real graphic on them. And so I remember being taken out of the scene with all that talk passing forth, back and forth of, wooden cardboard things.
I mean,
it's amazing how much props can throw you. I was just watching Jack Reacher, and if you ever try to eat in an acting in a scene, it's so difficult to just sit there and eat a plate of eggs and hash browns and drink a cup of coffee talking to somebody on camera, and do that naturally. And props is crazy hard. So I think I remember getting thrown by the props.
That reminds me of a story I heard about Star Trek VI when Shatner ate so much blue noodles he got sick.
Yeah, by the end of those scenes, you're spinning in a bucket,
man.
Keep eating all that stuff, and, props are tough. But that's definitely a good scene. I just, if we could go back in time, I'd make it better.
Oh, man. Well, it was a great scene. I think you really nailed it for what it was, but to be able to see it now, that'd be cool, too.
And I think it was played the way it was supposed to be played, because in the end, I mean, your character's supposed to be turned down by this. I mean, like, you did all the research, you have all the data to back it up, but the answer is still no. So if the scene wasn't played out the way it was, it wouldn't inspire Icheb to go take matters into his own hands in a few minutes later in the episode.
Yeah, I can't win here, right? Of course.
Right.
Absolutely, yeah. So let's go back to Heavy, shall we? Because in Astrometrics, Seven is observing Earth's landscapes in the computer's database. Janeway offers to show her around, but Seven notes she may not make it back to Earth. Janeway explains she's not giving up, and Seven notes that several crew members have died in the Delta Quadrant and that Janeway accepted their deaths. She explains that she's failed and that she'll be hard for Janeway to accept in that her demise. Janeway says that Seven has exceeded her expectations and that she would be losing a dear friend. I'm a little surprised you didn't grab this as a clip, Matt, because this is a really touching scene between those two.
I had to make tough decisions on what to pull for clips in this because all these scenes are so close together and they're all so good.
Yeah.
But the thing that I like about this scene is that they call out what people say about Star Trek sometimes is that, Ensign so-and-so will die and will not even blink an eye. And it's especially kind of weird for this show, given that they have no crew to replace said dead ensigns all the time. So, it's good to see that, they do acknowledge that, yes, people have passed away, but they never really impacted Janeway because, yeah, she cares about the crew, but, this is someone who's actually close to her, that someone that feels like a daughter. So, I like seeing that distinction played out here.
I like that they called it out on it, and Janeway explained it, too. I mean, yes, there's the old show don't tell, but I think we got shown in the emotion more than being told, I guess, here.
Well, show don't tell is a problem if the scenes don't feel essential. All this, like, I couldn't edit this episode. It's edited wonderfully the way it is. There's nothing here that feels extraneous or you know, takes away from the main plot of the story. Every scene here, I feel, and this is rare for a lot of Star Trek episodes, but I feel like every scene here is essential.
Right. That's not exposition, too. I mean, they're having a conversation. People have conversations all the time.
Right.
So it's less about this is what happened in the story and more about this emotional moment between those two.
Can I jump back and nitpick?
Yeah, do it.
The weakest part of the episode was when we first got on and we first started talking, those aliens in the Borg field, in the debris field. And those guys were so weak. What
were they?
I said that they were a bastard child between Klingons and Kazon.
They just were so weird looking and so just non. I wasn't scared of them, and they were just like the makeup was like, I don't know. It seemed like they half-assed those guys. That's just me. I don't know.
I don't want to call anybody out on anything, but I feel like it was something that we go into the Borg field, and we have a lot of people mentioning just before that, well, the Borg could show up. The Borg do come back for their own stuff. The Borg could be here. And if it had been the Borg, then it would have been an episode about the Borg, and that's not what the episode's about. So we had to come up with a quick alien of the week for some reason. And
But I don't know. Maybe it was just that guy. He just looked so weird, and I don't know. No offense to that actor, whoever he is. It probably isn't his fault either, but I wish that scene would have been written. If the episode's written so well, that scene's so kind of just quick. And, you know, it could have been that could have been written a little better. That's if I were the guy. I don't think I could have written it any better, but someone could have.
written better than stereotypical pirate guy.
Yeah. Oh, it's me, pirate guy. I own this place. I don't know.
So I think we're getting about to the rush to the finish here. But you mentioned that scene. I feel like that scene is more the rush to action than the rush to finish, wouldn't you say, Ben?
Yeah. Rush to, it could have been better, that's all.
So I think we're getting a little to the rush to the finish here. So the Doctor presents...
There doesn't have to be a rush to the finish.
No, I don't think there is. I mean, there is in the sense that once Ichab takes the implant out, someone's got to take it before it becomes bad. But it's... I don't know. I wouldn't call it rush to the finish. Is that it's more like, you know, this is the emotional crux of the episode. This is the climax of the story.
Good. I'm glad that there's kind of a consensus on this because I wanted to say rush to the finish to see if it would evoke a response. I really don't feel like it's that way this week, and it makes me kind of... I mean, I know we're fresh into Season 7, but I feel like we're breaking the mold in a good way.
No, this is all for the better. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I'm with you. I don't even know what you guys... I mean, I think I have a pretty good idea of what you guys mean by rush to the finish, but... I wouldn't say that, you know, the last time we did the episode where it was definitely a rush to the finish with getting the Borg pod back, Jeb's out and the frickin' bomb in, getting away from the burden. This was more of a, you know, it's really nice, the drama that builds to the end of the episode, and then there's a good, I don't know, 5, 6, 8 minutes that the episode kind of ends on more of a somber, fun, character-y note and not a big... bad, you know, big epic conclusion. It's more of a healing.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Oh, I love that healing. That's so good for that last bit too.
It is, and usually what we mean by rush to the finish is exactly what you said. Said bad guy of the week will come in. There'll be a phaser fight between Voyager and whoever the bad guy is. It may be the Borg that week. It might not. And then it usually ends with the Voyager warping away in a blaze of glory, and they've accomplished what they've accomplished for the week.
Right. Yeah, I think this episode breaks that mold, for sure.
Yeah,
absolutely, because the Doctor presents Ichab's case to Janeway and Seven. Seven refuses, but Ichab pleads to Janeway. Seven and the Doctor return to sickbay, and Seven is in bad shape. I kind of skipped over that a little bit, but there was a nice bit in the meeting room between Ichab and Janeway when, you know, he's talking to her about, you know, I can't believe you don't want to go for this. And, I mean, she's right on board, but she's still kind of... I think it falls to the detriment that Ichab is still seen as a kid here. And that's all about to change.
Yeah. No, I think you absolutely need to be seen that way in this particular scene, because here you have the Doctor says no, Seven says no. Janeway says no. Mm-hmm. So Ichab's got to take matters into her own hands, become an adult, and make it a very adult decision.
Yes, because Ichab calls the doctor to Cargo Bay 2, and the doctor notes that he'll make it clear that persistence is futile. Oh, that line.
So funny.
Oh. Oh, so ham-fisted and so good for this episode. I just ate that up. I literally laughed out loud when I heard it the first time. So the doctor meets Janeway, also on her way to the cargo bay, and they find Ichab, sweaty and shaking. He's deactivated his cortical node.
Ichab?
He's disengaged his cortical node.
How?
My alcove. I programmed it to disconnect my neural relays.
Can you reconnect them?
He's locked me out of the controls.
How could you do this?
It was the only way I could prove to you that it would work.
What's wrong with him? Ichab decided to perform a little operation on himself.
I have to reconnect his node immediately.
I intend to.
No. If Seven can refuse treatment, so can I.
We don't have time for this.
Check your scans. You'll see I'm already adapting.
Some of your implants have adapted, but not all.
Then apply the resequencing technique I researched.
This debate is pointless. I won't accept the node.
And I won't keep it.
Someone had better use the damn thing. If it stays disconnected much longer, it won't do either of you any good.
You're acting like a child.
I'm trying to save your life.
Only because you've grown too dependent on me.
So you think I need to learn to rely on other people?
Yes.
What about you? You've refused to rely on a single member of this crew. You hid your condition from the rest of us. You deactivated the doctor, and now you're rejecting my help. You're the one who needs to rely on others. Isn't that what people on this ship do? They help each other?
Whenever we can.
If the captain were dying, you'd risk your life to save her, wouldn't you? And when you respond to a distress call, you're risking the life of everyone on this ship to respond to the aid of strangers.
He's right.
Captain, he's just a child.
I don't think he is. Not anymore.
Doctor!
Don't look at me.
Please, just let us help you.
Mmm. That was tasty, huh?
Yeah, that little bit is so rich. That one little bit. I mean, we've said it before, the Jerry Ryan, the Kate Mulgrew, the Robert Picardo, those are your three, like,
heavy hitters.
Yeah, on this show. And, like, going into that scene and, like, logically knocking them all down. I mean, she's saying, no, no, put the cortical node back in. What are you doing? And the doctor's like, of course I'm going to turn it back on. He's just a kid. And Janeway's like, no, he's not. He's making grown-up decisions here, and, I mean, to really hit us over the head with the message they're trying to get across here, but, I mean, this is the heaviest, most intense part of the episode, yeah. And it was so well done.
Each head becomes a man in one scene. This is great.
Yeah. That's how character development's done.
Right?
One scene.
And talk about actory crap behind the scenes. I'll share a little here.
Oh, I need to know about
this. I knew how important this scene was to not only my career on the episode, my, you know, Paramount. I had to hit this scene. If I didn't hit this scene, I blew the whole episode, right? Mm-hmm. And it's heavy stuff. Anytime you have to go this emotional, this big, the hardest thing about acting for film is that controlled emotion, that place where you're not... In real life, you can yell at your girlfriend or yell at somebody, like, in that room, and you would yell louder than in a dramatic scene like that. So... But you still have to get yourself huffing and puffing and ready before you get to the controlled set where everybody is waiting to call action. So I'm on the Paramount lot, and I'm there's these little crappy, dumpy trailers that they keep out behind of that stage. And I'm just pacing up and down, freaking out, you know, 21 years old, freaking out, fearing that I'm going to blow the scene, but I'm just getting the dialogue because it's a lot of, like, it's a lot of wordy dialogue.
Yeah.
And I just remember pacing back and forth for at least lunch and maybe the hour after lunch while they lit that scene, you know, just in a full huff and puff rage, just getting myself emotionally ready to be like, I will die for you. You know what I mean? Like, that's just to get yourself to that place was, I remember stressing out heavily. And then when we finished shooting the scene, you know, I had to bring the energy to that room for those other actors to come off of. If I wouldn't have ballsed out and brought it, they have nothing to react to. So in a real sense, my acting chops, as far as my acting manhood, or for lack of a better word, with the rest of these heavy hitters, was also being tested in this scene.
Right.
So, you know, what? I had to come in there seriously in character and in the scene, and there was no time for ha ha ha, let's laugh, let's turn the cameras on. And so I'm over there in the corner dying, choking, before they, you know, did that beam in with where I'm being held by those two. So there was just a lot of build up to the scene. And then in the end, when we were all done, I told you earlier, but this was the scene when we were all finished, they were packing up the lights, and I'm walking off set. Picardo goes, "Well, every once in a while, one of you guest stars wakes us all up. You're a good actor, son," you know, and pats me on the shoulder. And I was like, you know, thrilled.
Oh, man.
Definitely, I think you said, excited and happy.
I think you said the words that every teenage boy wants to say to adults from time to time. Yeah, you can't. So it's believable in that sense, you know. I could put myself in those shoes and see that. I don't think I could do it myself. But you're right, though. If you didn't carry the scene, at least stand up for yourself, then the episode, it really doesn't work. All that time and hard effort, nothing. So, yeah, that was. I see why this is your favorite of what the work you've done on the show.
And that cliche character that I was so afraid of in the beginning, of this bratty kid who always says no, who just, I'm a little brat. I don't want to play the game. I don't want to, you know. I was so worried that that was what I was going to do for 2 years that I finally, there was great writing before this in a couple episodes, but this was definitely a moment where I went, okay, this whole, I don't know if I, you know, I know it now, but, you know, on a subconscious level, I knew that the whole franchise trusted me. The upper-ups, the Brandon Bragas, the Rick Bermans, the heavy hitters on the show, they wouldn't have written this if they didn't think I was a part of the team now, you know? So I just remember going home that night very just... Also, I had finished filming the episode that I'd called my mom crying about, that I thought I might change the world. It was all very, you know, looking back on it, emotional.
And obviously, from that great story you told from Germany earlier, obviously you did. So, yep.
Mm-hmm. So just to finish things up, 3 years later.
Yeah. So this where we break the mold of the rest of the finished. Later in Cargo Bay 2, Janeway and the Doctor wake 7. She's been out for 6 days. Icheb's recovery has been a little rocky, but he'll survive. The Doctor wakes him, and he says he intends to recover quickly. 7 explains she'll be helping him study, when Icheb notices her ocular implant is malfunctioning again. The Doctor scans her and says, actually, it's functioning properly. And a heartfelt, touching end to our really kind of roller coaster of an episode.
In terms of emotions, you mean?
Yeah. I mean, it's really been up and down. 7's perfectly fine now, all thanks to Icheb.
I pulled a Christian Bale while we were shooting this scene.
Oh?
Yeah.
Because I'm laying on my back. And when you're laying on your back, it's really hard because you look bad, and it's really sort of difficult to do a scene from, like, here. And I couldn't feel like I was in the scene, and I think we did 13 or 14 takes. And one time I stood up and was like, I'm not feeling this. I don't think I'm doing it right. I don't think we're getting the emotion. Fuck, shit, this guy. Started kicking sets and, like, punching my hand and just, I can't get it, I can't get it. And, you know, the director was, this was Livingston 2, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He's telling me, no, you know, we don't have to shoot it anymore. We got it. It's fine. You looked good. I saw the emotion there, but I got so lost in my head during this scene that I full on wigged out and I bailed out.
Oh, man. Well, great scene. I mean...
Oh.
great episode, I want to say. I don't want to say great scene every time I see you in a scene. No. But, I mean, this, the way it all wrapped up together, I mean, I'm not sure what kind of order they filmed things on these episodes. Was it really, like, chronological for the episode, or are you, like, filming the last scene, first day kind of thing?
We would shoot normally out of order. That was part of the fun of that's always part of the fun of making a movie, because rarely do you have the luxury of shooting a film or a television show in the order that it happens. In fact, I've never had that happen. So you have to kind of do these moment befores in your head and sort of figure out. But the fun part was, you know, always is to shoot a movie and you just go, I don't know how all this stuff is going to glue together. And then when after the editors do their magic, coming back and go, ah, it looks like one complete story, because, you know, all you're doing as actors and filmmakers is catching little moments, and
right,
the place they put it together in the end is in the edit.
So do you rely on a director there, or are you as an actor kind of left up to, you have to understand where you're coming from and where you're going right now?
Both. You know, it's both. Like, if you have any sort of question about where you came from the moment before and what just happened in the episode, if you don't have the cojones to ask and have someone, other actors or the director, clue you in, you're going to blow the scene, you know. There's one last behind-the-scenes thing I'll share that was kind of cute about that last moment. Picardo says something to the effect of, while we were rehearsing, I'm just laying there, and maybe I'll blame it on them for thinking I blew this scene, but Jerry and Bob are standing there, like, you know, eating carrots and a bagel or something while we're blocking it, and I'm laying there supposedly dead. I think Picardo says something to the effect of, she goes, pain I caused him. I think that's this episode. And Picardo says, pain he was willing to endure. And they kept making it sexual. So I'm laying there trying to get into the scene, and Jerry's going, pain I caused him, and then Picardo goes, pain he was willing to endure. And there was some other line that they made overtly sexual too, so they got me laughing while I was trying to be, you know, cryy and cute. That was always the case on this show. Anytime you worked with any of the boys, it was their game. It's terrible, but it was their game. At least the last couple seasons would be to try to screw each other up.
Was Robert Beltran part of that?
Oh yeah, all the Bobs, you know, the Bobbies and the Robs. Beltran, Neelix, Bob. Why can't I think of Robert?
Robert Duncan McNeil.
Yeah, Robert Duncan McNeil. Anytime the boys were on the set, it was a full-on fart joke, you know, say something overtly wrong right before action, add something onto the tail of the scene to try to get a laugh, you know. It was definitely mess-around time. And when the girls showed up, everybody straightened up. And especially when Kate showed up, it was like the camp fun fire getting ruined by the counselor, Kate.
Oh, no.
But we very much, like, in a real way, all respected her to the point where it was like, well, okay, no more fun time. Kate's on set. And we loved her for it, you know, because she did, you know, bring a, you can get out in the weeds when you're screwing with each other so much. And the boys definitely like to pull pranks. And Kate wouldn't have it, so when Kate showed up, it was like, okay, time to work. Sorry, serious now. Serious.
Oh, man.
I love that. That feels right and makes sense.
Yeah.
Captain, you know, on deck, everybody shut up.
Right, you hear stories about that. Like, season one, Next Generation, Patrick Stewart wouldn't have it. You know, I'm a trained theater actor, and nobody here is going to play pranks, and then, you know, like two or three seasons after that, he's, you know, joking around with everybody else on set.
Ruth in my pants now.
I will say that you're a bad boy if you pull pranks on mommy. So that's why that's okay.
I'm sure
that's why she ended up having the respect she did. Mm-hmm. I mean, she couldn't have played it anyway, any other way. That was the role she was going to have to play in order to be on set, you know, as a captain with the lead, doing something that, you know, she very much believed it, I'm sure.
Yeah. You know, and I'm sure no matter how good of an actor you are, I'm sure your relationship offset plays a lot into how you play the characters on set.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I remember she just gave me a look one time. Sometimes in a scene, you'll flub a line a couple times, and then you'll just get into a giggle fest, and you'll kind of lose your head, and you just start laughing for no reason. Mm-hmm. I was doing a scene in one of the episodes, and I was giving her like a speech about Captain Kirk. I was giving like a book report or something. Mm-hmm. And I started giggling, and I just couldn't stop giggling. And about the third time I blew the take, I remember Kate just looking at me with this, and she said, "Come on now."
Oh, wow.
And it was a look that it was the look in her eyes was just like, "You laugh again and make me sit here any longer than I have to, we're going to have a problem." You know, it was like, "Yes, oh, ma'am. God. Yes, ma'am. I will not." Come on. So,
you got the next take, I presume.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Nailed it. Let's move on.
Yeah.
Well, I think we did it.
Yep.
If there's anyone I wouldn't want to be stared down with on this cast, it would be Kate Mulgrew.
It's awesome, but, you know, it's... She commands a respect, but it's because, Ben said earlier, she was very serious about the work, and thank God she was, or the show wouldn't have been what it was.
Right.
I think she says that sometimes. There was a captain that they hired before her that turned the show down or something.
There was a captain that they hired before her who filmed like a couple of days worth of the pilot. But you can just see in the footage that they filmed that she doesn't have that commanding grasp. She's very timid, very shy, and that's not what Janeway needed to be. She brought what Janeway needed to be.
And did the girl quit or did she get fired?
No, she quit because she to her credit, she realized that this wasn't for her, so she quit, you know, after a day. So
yeah,
they weren't too far into filming so that they could bring in Kate Mulgrew.
And but I remember just hearing Kate at a show too, just say like, "Thank God that this woman didn't take this role because I was so blessed to get an opportunity to do that." So I mean, she was very serious. For God, however many episodes of the show are there? How many are there? Hundreds.
There's like 176.
Yeah, I think two.
That's incredible, man. Yeah. And yeah, for all I know, for the two seasons I was there, that girl went to work and every day was focused in and ready to get it done.
Come on now.
I don't remember Kate screwing around once. She was a nice lady. She was a pleasure to hang out with, but she was, you know, such a central focus point to getting moving, you know, and getting everybody focused.
And we can totally see that as fans because Ben and I have been to the Vegas convention and actually have gotten to see Kate Mulgrew speak. And even though she's there to have fun and interact with fans, when she walks on that stage, she commands attention. Like, you could just feel it. And, you know,
and she'll have a cigarette with you out back, but as long as you, you know, do your work first, and then right. She'll come out and just have a talk with you.
Well, I'll tell you this: anyone who could convincingly go from Starfleet captain to wife of a Russian mob boss is a good actress.
She's fantastic. Yeah, proud of her for that work too. I haven't seen her for a couple of years, and. Kudos to her for that show. She's incredible on that show.
And that pretty much is it for the episode, right, Gino?
That's it. The end.
End of episode.
Thanks, guys.
Well, before you go, we need you to, as all guests must, give your final thoughts and ratings on the episode. You know, the shortest sentence you can give it, maybe, or the longest one, doesn't matter, and your score out of 5 stars.
Out of 5?
Out of 5.
6.5, bitches.
Well, very nice.
That's it. That's all. That's a good show.
All right.
Well, I guess I'll go next, only because I think it's pretty obvious what I'm going to give this episode. This is by far my favorite Echeb episode. And actually, it is really an Echeb episode. I know Seven's the main focus of this episode, but it's really both your and Jerry's story. And you guys play so well off of each other, you know. And I think what speaks most to at least the quality of writing and the quality of acting that's in this episode is that I've never been in the situation, you know, thank God I've never been in the situation where someone I know close to me was dying and I had to make this decision. Of course I would make the same decision that each had would make. I just never have to have been in that emotional position yet. But the quality of the writing and acting is so genuine that I'm able to put myself in that position just from watching you two play off of each other. So I think that speaks volumes. It's an obvious 5 for me. I think this is one of my favorite of this final season, and maybe of the show. I'll have to go back and look at all 7 seasons, but really phenomenal episode. And kudos to you, and kudos to Jerry, and kudos to everyone who worked on this one.
Gino?
Okay, so, you know, as said before, I haven't seen these episodes to this point, and I mentioned it earlier in reading my notes that this really kind of breaks the mold for Voyager's formula, which for a show that's been so formulaic and episodic, I'm really glad they've changed it up because I feel like the show has fully come into its maturity. Having watched every other series to this point, you know, you see them all come into fruition about season 4, and the characters really start to kind of ooze into what they're eventually going to be. By the end of the Star Trek Next Generation, you could kind of see people getting a little lazy into their characters. You know, I've been doing this for so long, you know, just get out of my way. But, you know, we've still got newer people like Icheb on board, and like this Neelix, we've seen him evolve so much, and we've really got, like, postmodern Neelix now. And seeing our 3 heavy hitters really come into it. The thing that didn't really sink into me until I was a little bit into the episode and found out what it was really going to be about really kind of hit home for me, because I'm going through something exactly like that right now with my dad, and it's a weird situation to be in, because, you know, seeing somebody from Icheb's point of view and being able to do something about it is one thing, but being completely powerless really kind of makes you wish you were that character just so you had an option to present to somebody. And I think that this is probably one of the best episodes I've seen of Star Trek. So 5 stars.
Right on. Thanks, Gino. I'm going to share with you something personal. About 10 years ago, I was going through something similar with my father, and I thought he was going to die. You know, I was almost certain. So I don't know what, you know, the specifics of your family thing is, but my dad got his miracle, so hopefully it's you know, Christmas season comes around and yours gets his too.
Thanks.
Yeah, man.
But seriously, thank you for doing this and putting so much of yourself into it.
Thank you.
One of the best things about doing this review show is your ability to look back on things and having to force yourself to remember aspects that you do and don't like about, and be very honest with yourself about, you know, your enjoyment and what you do and don't, and to understand others' enjoyment as well, I think, is a really important part of what we do, you know, to figure all that out. And, you know, as I look back, every season has a first episode. There's Parallax, the 37s, Flashback, Gift, Night, Survival Instinct, and this one, Imperfection. And I'm glad that they are able to continue to refine themselves and get better and better as they go along. I mean, they did make this show a family, a show that was supposed to kind of be what family was in Star Trek, and I think they did a really good job. I think this is, and this does show you that the best thing about it in the end is that they get to do it through very old stories, you know, self-sacrifice, earning respect the proper ways, and I'm glad they're able to show and tell us those things. I'm glad that we stuck through it this far as well. So my rating's irrelevant, though, so 3 stars.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm a Benjamin guy, too. Like, for the most part, Star Trek, to me, you know, my favorite episodes were those, you know, I don't like the through line, the through story. For the most part, you know, I'm not a huge Trekkie. I liked all the films, but I never really watched any of the series. And I've always said it over and over again that Star Trek's sort of a space soap opera, and this is very much kind of like what I would typically think of as a soap opera-y episode, but written so damn well that it really worked for me. And so I was glad to be a part of it. But I usually like the Star Treks that are their own contained episode. that are usually about something more, you know, graphic novelish or what's the show I'm thinking of? Twilight Zone-esque.
Yeah. I was going to say, though, I think this episode shows that they can do both. And I think that's important for them to show. And I'm glad they did. It removes a lot of people. It removes the weight of any criticism against a show that says they can't do something. Because here they do. They do it better than some and as good as all.
About the best you can do a soap opera, that's for sure.
For sure. They do get CGI. It's always nice.
Yeah.
Hi guys, welcome to this week's feedback section. We're going to read the feedback from Unimatrix Zero Part 1. It's just me and Gino tonight, and Gino wasn't even on the episode, but he saw both parts.
Yeah, I watched them, don't worry.
He suffered, just like the rest of us.
Suffered? I don't know about that.
What, you loved being in Dreamland?
I think Part 1 was better than Part 2, that's for sure.
They both swim together in a sea of mediocrity. But anyway, you know who doesn't swim in that scene is Kieran McDuff. He's our first poster who says, so let me get this straight.
Wait a minute. Kieran, back this thing up. Are you seeing a post from Kieran McDuff here somewhere that I'm not seeing? Oh, the main one that's the very first one.
Yes.
I found my brain. Go ahead.
Yes, if you look up at post one, that is from Kieran McDuff, who says, so let me get this straight. If you plug all the Borg in, they can just meet up in some virtual construct world called Unimatrix Zero. Why not just call it the Matrix for short? Nah, this episode from 2000 is in no way a ripoff of that 1999 movie, is it? Well, they have to turn someone who has been unplugged from the Borg, unplugged from that world to help them. The chosen one, maybe? Is Seven the Neo of the Borg? I think this episode was ruined for me the minute I saw the similarities. It's a poor ripoff molded to further ruin the Borg as a decent bad guy. Although the Janeway pain scream, that at least raises the episode from a bad ripoff to bad comedy ripoff. Was she in pain or orgasm? I'm not sure, and neither am I, Kieran. I don't really want to rate this episode as it's only reached the halfway point, but I think at this point in the story we already know that it was a pretty poor cliffhanger. As you said, there was too many pointers to the fact that this was all part of the plan. If this cliffhanger was supposed to make you want the second part to come along quickly, I don't think this quite managed it in the way the previous cliffhangers have done. At this point, we all know roughly where the story is going, and with that and the fact that I already don't like the Matrix story, that I'm not really in any hurry to see the second part.
Now, are you meaning you don't like the story in the fact that it has a Matrix feel, or that you don't like the Matrix? Because our friendship may be in question.
The first one's okay. Those sequels get progressively worse.
What sequels?
Oh, you're one of those people. Very good.
There were sequels?
Yeah, there were sequels. I didn't know if you knew this.
Huh. I didn't know. Okay.
So, but there's no reason to see them, though. So from that perspective, it's probably just a 2 out of 5, and that's only because there's plenty of Jerry Ryan screen time. The softer 7 in The Matrix is a nice, subtle piece of acting that you can really appreciate. As far as looking back over the whole of Season 6 goes, I wouldn't say that the season plateaus. I understand if you averaged out, then you could say that, but I really don't like to average out a season when there's been some really good and really bad episodes in there. For instance, I loved Pathfinder, and I hate to think that its quality gets canceled out by the travesty of Fairhaven that follows it. I'd rather take those episodes separately, shipwreck the latter, and really enjoy the former. There's some real gems in Season 6, and I think perhaps the best thing about having gone through it with you guys is that I got to see 2 episodes I don't think I've ever seen before. And not only that, they were 2 of the best of the season in Riddles and Muse. For me, Season 7 is probably more a plateau than Season 6, but that's because I don't think that it has episodes that are either as good as the best of Season 6 or as bad as the worst of Season 6. But then again, Season 5 is probably better than Season 6, as it has more of the good episodes and less of the bad. Looking forward to Season 7, even if it is now a race to finish for the Delta Quadrant podcast.
I see what you did there. Man, I forget that Fairhaven's in Season 6.
And Spirit Folk. I've repressed them.
Man. That's crazy. So, up next, we have a wordy post from Tack. Tackarangalum says, wow, what a podcast. Packed with great conversation. I regret that I cannot write a quarter in fear of finger cramps and laryngitis for the poor sod who has to read this. First, this episode is fun for all the reasons I found its staff. If you turn off your brain, ignore the egregious treatment of the Borg, and just go with the flow, it's superficial fun. It's campy, it's corny, it's melodramatic, and exciting. It's fun to see the Queen act like a Bond villain. It's fun to see the Borg roaming through the forests like the Predator. It's fun to see Voyager take on an upgraded Borg cube. But it's all empty fun. If I didn't care about this episode's impact on Star Trek canon or care that Trek was reduced to cheap, mindless fun, well, I might have enjoyed the new Trek movies, too.
Or if you actually knew what fun was or actually, you know, had taste.
Okay. So, yeah, this episode feels like a sellout in a very cynical way. Straight good versus evil. The good are innocent, helpless, simple people that come with a love interest free of charge. The bad is the most marketable Trek antagonist, hamming up the evil on top of unnecessary viciousness with a side of puppy hating if you're confused on who's who. Big SFX, big action, but no deeper story and no big ideas. I like Melissa's Dante's Inferno idea, but alas, that wasn't the story they told. Without remembering what they were doing in the real world, they live blissfully ignorant in another Star Trek paradise of boredom a la the Baku, etc. And mark your calendars, because I think Janeway shouldn't have put her crew in danger to save others. For once, I'm convinced that she should have been self-centered and moved on. Seriously, they've come this far just to play a huge, ridiculous gambit just to free a microscopic 1/1,000,000,000th of the Borg in hopes it won't? Wait, but in hopes that a tiny infinitesimal pebble in the Borg shoe might turn the tide of war? No, it won't. Why couldn't the Borg identify who wasn't connected to the hive mind? And it's insanity when you think you can even pull off this crazy plan. Just walk away, Janeway. Let me say that more Mad Max style. Just walk away, Janeway. Chris, thank you for your defense of Chakotay. You, sir, were spot on. Good casting, bad character change. It's the fault of the producers. I'm glad they closed the issue between him and Janeway, but it still felt obligatory. Beltran plays his usual passive manipulation masterfully, but it's a bland character dynamic, especially if he's only allowed to threaten with mild inconvenience. Words of wisdom. If Borg Queen calls and says nothing, just hand over the call to your supervisor. Well done, Harry. Same goes if Michael Myers walks into your store or if quiet voice on the phone says, 7 days. Also, the Queen's line about Harry refers to their steamy affair in 7th season. Oh, thank you, Tech. I'll give it a 2. Keep up the great discussions. See you in Season 7. P.S. Season 6 is second best season, followed closely by Season 4. Season 5 is number 1. All right.
I don't know if I'd go with... it really depends on what happens when we finish Season 7, because my memory of Season 7 is that it was the second best, but...
Okay, all right.
that doesn't happen, by the way. There's no Queen Harry love affair.
Oh, man, I was kind of looking forward to that.
No. Sorry to burst your bubble. Also, I'd also have to say, if you happen to see Michael Myers walking into your store, he's not doing a very good job, because he's all about the shadows.
Unless he's hiding in, like, clotheslines.
That's true. next up, we have a comment from Professor Sub-Zero, who basically was being lazy and just pointed up and said what Tack said. There really isn't an element of the story I liked. Yeah, I guess you could say it was well-executed crap, but I don't want to settle for that even when we were talking about the best villain in the history of the franchise. Bah, even assimilation is trivial now. I always accepted Picard being liberated because it was the first time. Then it made even more sense after First Contact, where it was revealed, or retconned, that he wasn't necessarily fully assimilated since he never willingly gave himself over. Then I accepted Seven because she was interesting. Then we get Seven's old shipmates who are afraid of the Borg. Then we get those damned kids. Now our cast is just willing to be assimilated and bounce right back like it's nothing. Bah, again. Since it is clearly not all that tough to win people back from the Borg, we've seen it done repeatedly now, is it morally right or acceptable to kill drones? We're seeing that they can be liberated and regain their humanity eventually. We see that some now are even free within their own minds. Since that humanity is still in there, and it is still just their bodies being used against their will, should we kill them? There were those few moments in The Matrix where they excuse killing anybody still plugged into The Matrix because they could be used as weapons. While they are still people, that never set right with me either. Since they are trivializing the threat and nature of what the Borg are, it makes me wonder about how they should respond to that threat. something to keep in mind if the idea of destroying billions of Borg comes up again.
I feel like he's foreshadowing something there. But, you know, I think they kind of answer that question of are they people in this two-parter right here. You know, when you see them in the Unimatrix Zero, it has to be implied that though the 1 billionth or whatever actually show up in there, have that consciousness, it's almost safe to assume that all of them have some sort of consciousness like that.
Yeah, but the problem that I think he's saying is that the episode wants to have it both ways.
Well,
it's saying that, you know, these people are special, but we should kill the rest of the Borg.
You know what happens when you try it both ways, don't you? It doesn't work. Anyway, up next, a post from Sareki, who says, regarding the episode, I just have one thing to say and a rating for this week. Wow. She says, yes, B'Elanna is the best. I'm glad we all agreed about that. Unimatrix Part 1, 3 of 5. Regarding Season 6, this is how I would rank the seasons. 5, 4 and 7 tied. 6, 3, 1, 2. I think I agree with the point that Season 6 has some of the highest highs and some of the lowest lows, but I think that Season 6 may suffer from following Season 5, so it seems worse than it is. Great podcast, everyone.
I'm actually going to echo Sareki. I think that's how I would rate them, too, if memory serves me about Season 7.
You know, so. It's so hard for me to compartmentalize these into specific seasons because I've been...
5 is clearly the best. Can we all just agree on that? That had really good... That had good highs.
You know, I think I would get a better feel for it if I was, like, marathoning a watch-through. But doing it this way, I'm watching one episode a week. So it's really kind of hard to break it up by season, you know? I'm still, you know, I have a feel for what episodes I really liked and what episodes I really didn't like. And they were in different seasons. But as far as grouping them together, I'm not sure.
Well, one thing's for sure. I don't ever think you'll subject yourself to Rise again.
I would watch Rise continuously for a week, then have to watch the episode Nemesis.
Every. Oh, that. Yeah, Strangely enough, I think I agree with you. Rise is better than Nemesis.
I mean, at least we have, like, the fight out on top of the thing, and somebody gets thrown
some
off.
Some really funny, poor, bad CGI.
Ah!
And no stupid, you know, effing dumb language.
Yeah. I'm not even going to mirror it. Let's get out of here. That's it for everybody. That's it for our feedback this week.
Yep, that's it for our feedback this week. If you want to get a hold of us, you could do it in a number of different ways. You can leave us an email at deltaquadrantpodcast@gmail.com. Leave a comment on our forums at forum.trekmatefamily.com. Follow us on Twitter at deltaquadrantcast, QUADT_cast, and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/deltaquadrant. Also, we love 5-star iTunes reviews. As this show comes to a close, we really appreciate hearing from you guys, and hopefully you've been enjoying the show, and when you leave those 5-star reviews, they really do help out the show. Gino, where else can they listen to us besides iTunes?
You can always check us out on Stitcher. You can also go to trekradio.net from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays. And don't be afraid to send us stuff, you know, as the show comes to an end. Let's say that right now, and in your listening read-through, you've just come across the podcast, and we're already done with it. I'm pretty sure that we're still going to man these communications long after the show is done, so send us stuff. I mean, I'm happy to still talk about it. I know for a fact, as soon as we're done with this podcast, I'm going to go watch the show over sequentially to see more of those things about continuity and the things that we don't like to talk about on the show.
Or that we're not allowed to.
Right.
But, definitely, we'll still interact beyond the show's ending. We may not be able to do it on air, but we'll still get back to you.
Great.
Thanks so much, guys, and we'll see you next week when we wrap up Unimatrix Zero for good.
See ya.
Well, thank you for coming on, Ichi Arya. That's how you go. Sorry. Can't help myself, you know. That's how I see it. So, but thank you for coming on, Manu. It was a pleasure getting to review these episodes with you and getting your perspective on it.
Absolutely. And, you know, while you're here, of course, this is an opportunity. What are you working on right now? Tell us where else we can find you right now.
Everybody go to www.fifthpassenger.com. That's 5thpassenger.com if you haven't yet, and check out the trailer. We did a Kickstarter. We raised 80 grand. We're trying to get matching funds and trying to make this thing for $250,000. January 13th is when we'll start shooting. But we have shot the trailer. Really, really smart Bob Picardo, me, Tim Russ, Marina Sirtis, Doug Jones, myself. I think I said me already, but I like saying that twice. Great, you know, it's a really, really smart script that I got a hold of like 4 years ago, and it's been a long process to try to get the money together to make this movie. Space thriller with a really just smart ending. Just a really, really smart screenplay that I'm excited to make. Beyond that, there's a, you know, I had five films this year at the American Film Market trying to get out there. A film called The Green Fairy about absinthe and the history of absinthe that I did with Roddy Piper. Benjamin Troubles, the Blue Jean movie, dark comedy. I've got a movie called Promises coming out, a Western called Six Gun Savior. And there's a couple more in the boat that I can't think of at this moment. But anybody if willing to look up my name and how it's spelled and check me out on IMDb, that always helps me. And follow me on Facebook or Twitter at Monuente Reme. Oh, Dark River's coming up too. But
awesome. Well, of course, thank you so much for being here. And thanks for coming back. I mean, it means we didn't scare you off last time.
No, man, you guys are cool, man. This was this is what's so great about this show. I haven't, you know, we shot Renegades last year. I guess I could probably say something a little bit about that too, dumbass. New Star coming out that pretty soon here, so I'm pretty excited about that. But what's neat about this show is, you know, 15 years off of it, I still find myself in rooms in the middle of, you know, right now on the internet with a bunch of people all over the place, wherever you guys are at. Having really true emotional connection and conversation about, you know, humanity, and the fact that this show just keeps doing that over and over and over again. And, you know, I was in Germany recently with like 300 people in a room, and I just did a couple of two-hour talks. And in the beginning of the talk, I just said, you know what, if you guys have questions, I don't care if it's about Star Trek, I don't care if it's about why the sky is blue, I don't care if it's about politics, religion, whatever the hell, let's just sit and have a conversation about what it is to be here since we're all here. And this show has allowed me to do that so many times that's what I'm most thankful for. So I'm thankful for you guys too. Thank you.
I feel completely honored, and I don't know how we can top that, so we'll just say thank you again so much. We don't get this perspective often. It's really special when we do. So, again, thank you from all of us. And until next time, this is Matt in Arizona closing Hailing Frequencies.
And this is Ben in Arizona saying, adios.
And this is Gino in Oklahoma. See you on the other side.
And this is Manu and Tereme. Onward.
Thanks for listening to the Delta Quadrant. Please join us again next week. Star Trek Voyager and the Voyager theme song are the property of CBS Television Studios, and no infringement is intended.